Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happened after the fall of the Roman Empire? To read many Western accounts of history, the progress of the civilized world was all but extinguished after Rome's decline, with high culture, science, and art lying in wait to come roaring back to prominence during the Renaissance. But these accounts neglect the entire eastern half of that empire, centered for more than a millennium in what today is Istanbul, Turkey. Meanwhile, the Byzantine Empire was educating both its sons and its daughters in unprecedented numbers, preserving literature and sacred religious texts, and effectively shielding the rest of Europe from invasion. So why haven't we paid more attention? My guest today can explain that, and he hopes at the same time to change it. Lars Brownworth is a former high school history teacher and creator of the sleeper podcast sensation 12 Byzantine Rulers. His new book is called Lost to the West, the Forgotten Byzantine Empire that Rescued Western Civilization. Lars, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with some definitions here. At its height, what areas fell under the control of the Byzantine Empire?
That would be in the 6th century after Justinian's reconquest, and a little part of Spain, all of North Africa, and around the Mediterranean. Basically, the lands of the old Roman Empire, excluding what is today France and England.
And they always, the Byzantines always considered themselves Romans.
That's right. They would have, if you had asked them who they were, they would have identified themselves as Roman, with emperors that stretch back in line from Augustus Caesar, the first emperor.
And in fact, they were organizing Byzantium as a major power center before Rome actually fell.
That's right. A previous Roman emperor named Diocletian in the 3rd century actually split the empire in half. And his idea was that it was just too large. You couldn't put down a revolt in Spain one day and then Turkey the next day. It was too large to be ruled by one man. So he broke it up in half according to linguistic barriers. So Western half spoke Latin, the Eastern half spoke Greek, and he set up two different emperors who would theoretically work together.
And you say theoretically. Was there, in fact, a lot of collaboration between the two?
Yeah, they were actually more rivals than they were colleagues. And every once in a while, an emperor from the West or an emperor from the East would try to take over his counterpart, and sometimes he'd be successful.
So beyond the language barrier, what made the Byzantine Empire so different from the western half of the Roman Empire, and what made it more ultimately able to sort of withstand the decline of the Roman Empire?
Well, the first answer to that is Constantinople was a superb city. It had really great fortifications, natural defenses. It was also on a trade route that could keep it wealthy, could supply it with food, and made it almost impossible to take. So Rome, you know, by contrast, was very vulnerable to invading armies. But what really divided the East and the West was the East had been Hellenized and was much more sophisticated, wealthy, and cultured toward the end of the what we would call the Roman Empire.
When you say Hellenized, you mean influenced by Greek thought and culture?
Right. When Alexander the Great sort of went east to India, he brought Greek culture with him, and that really sunk in, had deep roots, and Rome spread over that like a thin veneer.
Can you talk about how the Byzantines approached education?
Yeah, they really tried to continue the classical traditions of primary and secondary education. A lot of times, students would be required to memorize large sections of the Odyssey or the Iliad, for example. And they broke down their curriculum into the same as the ancient Romans, with rhetoric, grammar, et cetera. Learning how to speak in public was very important. And they educated their females as well as their males. You know, boys and girls attended schools, had private tutors, and Constantinople had one of the world's first universities sponsored by the state.
What's really interesting about this whole phenomenon is that, and we'll get to Constantinople in just a moment, this was a sort of a Christian capital, and yet that education was secular in nature.
That's right. That's one of the real strange things about looking at Byzantine history, because there's this tension. They don't really trust the pagan classics. They're too laced with secular reasoning. But they're also beautiful, and they're a part of their past and their heritage. So they believed that with careful study, you could separate the chaff from the wheat, is how they put it. And it was worth studying. There were things in there that were, even though there were stories of gods running around and creating all kinds of mischief, it was still worth studying. It had enduring moral lessons that you could draw.
So you talk about not trusting the pagan classics in certain ways. We do, though, get the sense, reading this book, that there was this remarkable interplay between different cultural influences and different kinds of belief. Was it a tolerant place?
It was tolerant at times and very intolerant at other times. For example, during the iconoclastic controversy, when they decided that any depiction of the divine in paint or carving or something was blasphemous, so they really destroyed a lot of their art. Those emperors, as you might suspect, were not very tolerant. But at other times, you had emperors who had vast private libraries and tried to collect as many of the ancient Greek and Roman writings as they could. So it really depended where you were and what time you were there in the empire.
Lars Brownworth is my guest. His new book is called Lost to the West, The Forgotten Byzantine Empire That Rescued Western Civilization. Throughout the book, Lars, you have some great sort of portraits of these different emperors. And what's so interesting is how many of them seem to have sprung from places we would not imagine would breed an emperor. Can you talk about how Byzantine emperors came to power?
Yeah, and that's another really interesting facet of Byzantine history is you think of it as a very autocratic society, very strict. You can't escape from where you're born. And yet, as you pointed out, there's all these emperors who were peasants and wrestlers and actresses, actors, and it's surprising in that way, and that's because the principle of a father being succeeded by his son was always there in imperial history, but it was never really set in stone that a son had to follow the father. A lot of times it was based on popularity, and Constantinople was the all-important city. If you could be there and distribute some money and win yourself some favor, it didn't really matter if you had noble blood. You know, you could the greatest Byzantine emperor of them all, Justinian, started life as a peasant from what we would today call Macedonia.
Was there a sense once they were installed that these emperors had in fact been divinely anointed?
Yeah, that was very much the justification that I'm successful, therefore God must have been at my back.
Let's talk for a minute about Constantine, for whom the capital of Byzantium was ultimately renamed. He was very much defined as a man and as a leader by his religious conversion. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, it's very hard to go back and say, was that, you know, what exactly happened with Constantine? Was he a political opportunist who just realized that Christianity had some benefits and would make him appear as the great protector, unifier? Did he actually have a religious experience? It's very hard to tell at this distance in years, but I think some religious experience did happen to him. But I don't think he ever really understood Christianity. He certainly was immensely arrogant, conceited. He had himself buried as in the position of Christ with 12 apostles around him. Probably saw himself as some sort of a, you know, reborn Christ or something.
Yeah, he told a very curious story about how he decided to follow Christianity.
That's right. He said he had a vision as he was about to attack Rome and displace another man who was claiming to be emperor. And he claimed that he saw the sun be superimposed, or a cross rather, be superimposed over the sun, and the words with this sign, conquer. So he then had it, and he said he at first said that the entire army saw it, and then later on he changed his story and said that it had been explained to him in a dream. So if actually if the vision had taken place where the whole army saw it, it was the best kept secret.
They didn't remember.
They didn't remember. No one else wrote an account.
When you say he didn't really understand Christianity, what do you mean by that?
Well, he certainly didn't understand things like humility or forgiveness. For example, his oldest son, Crispus, was getting pretty popular. He had had a dashing role in making Constantine the single emperor of the Roman world. And when Constantine would march along with him, he'd notice that soldiers would sing songs to his son almost, maybe even a little more than they would sing songs to him. So he accused his son of having an affair with his current wife, and then had the son killed. And then later on, I guess, felt bad about it and had his wife killed. So he definitely did not understand the whole humility and forgiveness thing.
Do unto others.
Yeah, right.
There was a major upheaval for the empire when, in fact, Rome finally and officially fell. Can you talk about Zeno and how he was able to protect and preserve at least the eastern territories?
Yeah, Zeno is one of the most fascinating emperors precisely because of that. He's a barbarian, an Assyrian, from a really mountainous part of Turkey today. And he came in and he never really felt secure at home. In Constantinople, and he's chased from power, actually, just as Rome is sort of on its last leg. Zeno falls, he eventually comes back, but in the meantime, while he wasn't there, Rome had fallen, so the Eastern Empire couldn't help out its Western counterpart. But the way Zeno preserved the East from suffering the same fate is really his predecessor Leo as well. They broke the back of the barbarians controlling the government, because what happened in the West is the barbarians were so powerful that they eventually said, why even rule through a puppet? Why not just rule it outright? Let's carve it up into petty kingdoms. And the same thing was happening in the East. But Leo, the Emperor Leo, appointed Zeno, who was at the time a general, to counterbalance the barbarians in the empire. And then Zeno finished the task of executing, really, and driving out the barbarian elements of the empire. Without those two men, the Roman Empire probably would not have survived.
How were the armies organized within the Byzantine Empire?
It was very much a relic of that late Roman society where it wasn't one army like we think of the Roman army, the legionaries, or the Greek hoplites. Everyone sort of looks the same. The Byzantine army, later on in its history, it was just a collection of mercenaries. But even toward in the very beginning, there was a collection of heavily armed horsemen, cataphracts, and then there were your archers, your bowmen, your spearmen, your swordmen, and they were all fighting under their own commanders, and lots of different languages in there as well. It really wasn't one unified army that we'd think of.
Well, it's amazing to think about them being able to orchestrate, even figuring out exactly what they were fighting for and which territories they needed to control.
Yeah, it must have been a nightmare of logistics.
Lars Brownworth is my guest. He's a former high school history teacher and creator of the internet podcast 12 Byzantine Rulers. That's a series. His new book is called Lost to the West, the Forgotten Byzantine Empire that Rescued Western Civilization. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lars Brownworth. He's a former high school history teacher and creator of the podcast series 12 Byzantine Rulers. His new book is called Lost to the West, the Forgotten Byzantine Empire that Rescued Western Civilization. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Lars, what sort of ongoing threat was there from the Persians?
The Persian War was always rumbling. It really never ended. They would sign peace treaties, but even, for example, they signed a peace treaty called the Everlasting Peace, but even which lasted for 6 years. but even when there was an official peace between the two empires, there were always border raids. There were always on both sides going both ways, and they're never really. It was, you could just look at it as a 300-year war with occasional pieces.
Was there, in fact, a lot of what we would consider today true diplomacy practiced at that time, or was it sort of a rare thing for people to come together without arms in hand?
I think we probably wouldn't recognize it as today as diplomacy, but there were a significant number of people, you know, Byzantines who spoke Persian and Persians who spoke Greek or Latin, who would go over. Usually it would be through the means of letters, where the monarchs would write each other and try to insult each other.
tell us a little bit about Justinian, who you portray as really the greatest emperor of the Byzantine Empire.
Yeah, he was the ultimate, I guess, the little guy who made it big. He starts out life with nothing. He's a peasant. His uncle happens to be the reigning emperor, and who sponsored. And his uncle seized power. He was just a peasant as well. But he notices that Justinian, there's something special about this guy. He's very bright, and so the emperor decides, I'm going to give him the education that I didn't have. So he brings him to Constantinople, which is the most cosmopolitan city in the empire at the time. And just showers him with everything he didn't have, makes sure he has the finest education, really steeps his mind in the Greek and Latin classics of the Roman Empire. And when Justinian, he becomes the power behind the throne, directing his uncle, telling him what to do. And when he becomes emperor, he has this idea that, you know, the Roman Empire was great once. When Justinian's ruling, it's just the eastern half. The west is gone to these barbarian kingdoms. And he has this idea, let's restore the Roman Empire to greatness. But instead of just dreaming that, he goes ahead and he does it, and he reconquers most of the western lands. And along the way, he falls in love with an actress, which is a bit like, I don't know, a president falling in love with a prostitute. and he marries her, overcomes the laws that were against that sort of thing, and it turns out to be this inspiring match. And the two of them really reshape the world, or the Mediterranean world, anyway.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Lars Brownworth about his new book, Lost to the West, The Forgotten Byzantine Empire That Rescued Western Civilization. Let's go to the phones and speak with Peter in Fort Worth. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have always approached or been introduced to the history of the Eastern Roman Empire through the perspective of Christian history. And one of the things that I recall was that even the early Christian councils, such as the one in 325 in Nicaea, I believe, and then in Constantinople itself in 381, were actually in part politically motivated, not simply by disagreements among Christians trying to set out what would be the creeds at the time, but also that there was a role in those councils in maintaining the unity of the empire, and I wanted to see if that was in fact the case and to what degree.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a great question. Constantine, it's absolutely the case that Constantine wanted to unify Christianity. When he was rising to power and overthrowing all the other emperors, he needed some cause to get behind, to pose behind. For example, if there were Christians in his opponent's territory and they were getting persecuted, Constantine could announce that he's the protector of Christians and then come in and have some good PR that way. But once he was the sole Roman emperor, the Christians, there had never been this is what we believe, this is the, you know, this is our one holy work, so on. This is the day we're going to celebrate on. This is how we're going to do it. They'd never thought about questions like this. And so there was a lot of internal squabbling within the Christian church. So once Constantine had united the empire, suddenly he found that he had a squabbling Christians on his hands, which was sapping his authority, sapping his energy. And one of the reasons for the Council of Nicaea was to stop that. There was a major division in Christianity. It's called the Arian controversy on the question of who Jesus was. Was he God? Was he just a man? Was he a little bit of both? Was he inferior to God the Father? And Constantine really, as I was saying, he didn't really understand Christianity. He didn't care which side won as long as a side won. But it was those councils were definitely motivated to unify Christians as much as to unify the empire.
And in terms of preservation of Christian texts, you know, a lot of people are familiar with that book from a decade or two ago, How the Irish Saved Civilization. But in fact, it sounds here like the Byzantines saved civilization.
I would definitely make that case. I think the Irish preserved what Latin classics there were in the West, and certainly knowledge of writing. The Irish monasteries, the Irish monks did preserve that, absolutely. But without the Byzantines, there wouldn't have been any of the Greek writings or any of the, or a lot of the, like Plato and Aristotle, for example, would have been totally lost to us. And a lot of the ancient Greek works were transmitted through Arab pens, but the Arabs got it from the Byzantines. So I guess what I'm trying to say is without the Byzantines, there wouldn't have been much for the Irish to say.
And this is tens of thousands of documents.
Yeah, I think 40,000 of the 55,000 ancient Greek manuscripts that we have come directly from Byzantine sources.
Wow. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Ken in Wise County. Hey, Ken.
Hello, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
A most interesting show, thank you. And I had a question. I spent, as a side benefit, if you will, of my 9 years in the intelligence business, in 69 I spent a month in Turkey and managed to get to a lot of the sites. But there was one in particular in Sinop. They had discovered a floor of a Byzantine church. I got to the other great sites of Byzantium in Constantinople and Istanbul and some others, but I was wondering if the author had anything about the Sinop, Byzantium up there.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
I've never actually been to Sinop. Most of my travels to Turkey have been on the coast, the western coast. But I have been to several Byzantine churches or the ruins of them in Jordan and other areas, and it is quite beautiful, but unfortunately I really don't know anything about Sinop.
They had some remarkable contributions to architecture, even as it is practiced today. Can you talk about that a little bit?
That's right. Well, the most, I guess, the stunning example is the Hagia Sophia, which is a dome on top of a square. And it formed a template, really, for most mosques today, based their basic shape from the Byzantine basilica. If you look at the Dome of the Rock, for example, that was built with Byzantine craftsmen, actually. So there's that architectural legacy still.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to LV in Dallas. Hi, LV.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller.
Welcome.
I wanted to ask the author, during the period of 193 and 211 A.D., Rome's first African-born ruler, I think I'm saying his name correct, Septimius Severus, does he know anything about his rulership?
Yeah, the Byzantine history is a little funny because it's really just Roman history, so where you consider the beginning of it is open to question. Septimius Severus is actually before where most scholars put the Byzantine Empire. He was a very strong ruler, founded a the last stable dynasty of what, you know, we would call the old Roman Empire before it was divided. A very interesting ruler, but not usually considered Byzantine.
Can you talk to us a little bit about King Irene? Her story strikes me as one that would have impressed Shakespeare.
Yeah, she was quite an impressive woman. She ruled by her. She took the title of the male emperor. Decided she didn't want to rule. She was originally a regent for her son Constantine, who was a bit of a weakling and had just no ambition to rule. So she said, "Why should I not rule just because I happen to be the quote wrong gender?" And she ended up actually killing her son when he tried to assert himself.
This was not Constantine the First.
It was not Constantine the First, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But she was actually proposed to by no one less than Charlemagne.
And turned him down?
Well, she actually accepted, but there was no way the courtiers of Constantinople were going to let some boorish Frank with his ridiculous trousers marry the empress of the true empire, so they overthrew her.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We also have email coming in to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Prakash in Hearst. Hi, Prakash.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, during the Byzantine Empire, did they have contact with India? And if the author can go in more detail. Thank you.
Thanks.
Toward the beginning of the Byzantine Empire, in the reign of Justinian, there were rather far-flung contacts, especially with China. I don't know of any specific contacts with India, but when the Byzantines started persecuting the different Christian sects that weren't Orthodox, some of those, the Nestorians, for example, ended up in India. But I don't know of any specific trade contacts with them.
Yeah, how did that work during much of the empire? Was most of the trade taking place within, or were there, in fact, a lot of routes that took people from inside the Byzantine Empire beyond to bring goods back?
It was on a major, Constantinople is on a pretty major, on the Silk Route, also the Black Sea, the Russians, anything going by sea has to pass by Constantinople, so it's sort of a natural place for trade. And Byzantine merchants, of course, it changes over the empire, but toward the beginning and middle of Byzantine history, their traders really did ply the routes all, you know, North Africa, Spain, Sicily, the islands there in the eastern Mediterranean. Toward the end of Byzantine history, they started getting into trouble and making questionable decisions, like turning over their navy and their trade to Venice, which didn't really work out too well.
In some cases, though, if they found something they really liked, they found ways to produce it within the empire, and I guess silk is a good example.
That's right. I think silk is the best example. Justinian was really tired of paying these ridiculous import taxes on silk. Everyone wanted it. He couldn't produce it. So he sent two monks to China, and they discovered the silkworms and the secrets of producing silk. So what they did was they smuggled some eggs inside hollowed-out bamboo canes. And when they came back to Constantinople, they presented it to him, as well as mulberry trees that they could eat. And they planted them in the capital, and the most lucrative Byzantine industry was born.
It's amazing to think how much sprung from that very small act.
Right, right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hey, I'm just out of high school, and I've been studying history in college recently. A lot of the history books in public schools kind of depict the fall of the Byzantine Empire with the fall of the Roman Empire. And I was wondering why that is, because as I've studied, I've seen that it stretches a lot more into Middle Eastern history, and I was wondering why that gets left out in favor of, I don't know, I guess European and Western history.
Are you asking why the fall of Constantinople is considered the fall of the Roman Empire?
Well, I'm wondering, I know that the eastern half of the Roman Empire tends to fall before the western half, and it always seemed to me like the entire Roman Empire, eastern and west, fell with that eastern half falling.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think one of the reasons why it's lumped in with Middle Eastern history, for the one reason, you know, geographically it has more in common, and also there was the East and the West really drifted apart, and there was a really great cultural divide between the East and the West that resulted in the West largely ignoring the East, and I think some of that is passively in our, like when I was in high school, we never learned about the Eastern Empire. So I'm impressed that you've learned about it.
Can you talk about why the Enlightenment thinkers were so down on the Byzantine Empire?
Yeah, they very much preferred to find their roots in classical Greece and Republican Rome. There was the spirit of the times was very much against autocracy, religion. These are things that the Byzantine Empire they're hallmarks of the Byzantine Empire. It's not the classical Greek. It's a sort of crowded medieval Greek. So nothing. They couldn't find anything good about it. It's, you know, far too superstitious. There's too many miracles. There's too many emperors running around with no recourse from the people. There's it just didn't suit their fancy, and which is a shame because the Byzantine Empire then. It's in a way, it's not democratic enough. It's, you know, for ancient Greece, and it's not Latin enough to be the Roman Empire, so it's ignored.
Lars Brownworth is my guest. His new book is called Lost to the West, The Forgotten Byzantine Empire That Rescued Western Civilization. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Lars Brownworth is my guest. He became an internet sensation with his series of podcasts called 12 Byzantine Rulers. Now he has a book out called Lost to the West, The Forgotten Byzantine Empire That Rescued Western Civilization. Join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. I recognize that this stretched out over some time, but can you talk about how initially the Byzantine Empire was able to weather the Crusades?
Sure. That was a crisis for the Byzantine Empire because they always suspected that these Western armies, which were supposedly coming to help them, were out to conquer Constantinople and the Byzantine Empire. But the Crusades were initially launched Byzantine Emperor named Alexius asked for help against the Turks, for armed help against the Turks. And instead the Pope sent this massive army to retake Jerusalem, which the Byzantines were less than thrilled about. Alexius was a very shrewd emperor, and everyone was coming overland. They were marching, and as you can imagine, that takes a long time. So they didn't all arrive at once. So Alexius knew his one chance was not to let them all arrive, because if they all came at the same time, then there was a threat that they would overwhelm the city. So he only allowed two or three of them in the city at once, and he made their leaders swear an oath of allegiance to him. He had a little show of force. He wowed them with expensive presents. It was a masterful performance, and they all swore allegiance to him, and he hustled them over to the other side before they could join up with the rest. And then the crusade went on its way, and conquered Jerusalem, and a few more crusades were launched. But the crisis, the only time they really had to weather a storm was that first crusade, where they had that brilliant Alexius I. The second time was in 1204 for the fourth crusade, and this time, unfortunately, they had a fool on the throne who badly botched it, and the crusader army ended up sacking Constantinople.
That's Constantine the 11th.
Constantine the 11th was the last Byzantine emperor in 1453. The emperor during the Fourth Crusade, his name was Alexius V, and he did not have a happy end.
What was the ultimate downfall? What was there a single event that ended the Byzantine Empire?
It's hard to pick a single event, but I think a lot of historians agree there was a very important battle at Manzikert in 1071, where the Byzantines got ambushed and annihilated by a Turkish army. And that allowed the Turks into Asia Minor. And as long as the Byzantines held Asia Minor, they had a virtually inexhaustible supply of men to draw from for their armies. After that battle, the Turks took Asia Minor, and then it was only a matter of time.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Walter in Dallas. Hello, Walter.
Hi. Thank you, Ms. Boyd and Mr. Barnwood, for this tremendously informative show. My question is, why are you referring to it as a Western civilization? And, you know, where is the line of demarcation between the Western and Eastern civilization, if it's an Eastern empire that deserved it? What civilization was it that the Western part of it came up with that the Eastern preserved? And, you know, if you look at it geographically, was it not an Eastern civilization? I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, you're exactly right. If you look at a map, there's no real, you know, sharp demarcation between what, you know, Eastern Europe and Western Europe. It really was just a linguistic divide. What had been conquered or influenced by the Greeks and what hadn't been, what then fell into the Roman, the Latin name. And that just arbitrary decision by the Emperor Diocletian to say this is the eastern half of the Roman Empire, this is the western half, really is still the dividing line between Eastern and Western Europe today. And that's the reason for it. But sure, if you look at a map, you know, there's no reason why we should be calling it Western or Eastern civilization.
We had an interesting author on a few months ago who did a world history as seen through Muslim eyes specifically, and there was a lot more discussion of what took place in the Byzantine Empire. Do you think that our failure in this part of the world to really pay attention to this accounts for some of the misunderstanding between these two cultures?
Absolutely. The Crusades is a great example. I think the Muslim world still sees the Crusades as a defining moment. And the Western world, I think, has largely forgotten the Crusades. But we've certainly forgotten the Byzantine side of that story, which is what launched the Crusades. The Byzantine perspective has been completely overlooked. And if we really want to understand the impact of the Crusades or the West on the East, you have to look at the gateway through which they came. You know, contact was made through the Byzantines. And so I think if we don't understand their story, if we don't know their story, it's going to be very hard to understand the history of that area of the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Gus in Dallas. Hi, Gus.
Hey, Chris and Lars. This might be slightly off subject, but I was wondering if you, Lars, could illuminate the split of the Roman Catholic religion from the Eastern Orthodox.
Sure. The official split came in the year 1054 over a word in the creed, determining if the Holy Spirit came from God the Father or whether it came from God the Father and Christ. And that question right there, the Orthodox decided, went with the original wording, which said the Holy Spirit came from the God the Father only, and the Roman Catholic, the Western half of the empire, decided to add, and the Son, that the Holy Spirit came from both the Father and the Son. There are also some other regional differences, such as in the Eastern tradition, priests could marry. In the Western tradition, obviously, they cannot. The use of unleavened bread for communion, things like that. But there are relatively minor details. But in the year 1054, there were mutual excommunications, and the world for the Mediterranean world, for all intents and purposes, split from a Christian whole into a Catholic West and an Orthodox East.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Larry in North Dallas. Hi, Larry.
Hi. There's a very interesting sidelight to the Byzantine Empire. They attempted in the 5th century to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And while they were excavating, they hit natural gas, and there was an explosion. So they took it as a sign of, you know, divine disapproval and abandoned the project. This is from a book by Lewis Brown, A History of the Jews, called Stranger Than Fiction.
Have you heard the story, Lars?
Yeah, that's actually the Emperor Julian the Apostate, and he tried to restart paganism, to sort of reverse the tide, to bring back paganism, to crush Christianity. And one of the reasons he, or one of the ways he decided to show up Christians is because Christ said the temple will not be rebuilt to the last days. So he said, I'll just rebuild the temple and show that Christ is a false prophet. So he spent significant resources trying to do that. And the Christian sources say there were fireballs which disrupted the project, and Julian was off to other things anyway. So I hadn't heard that it was, they were thinking it was natural gas. That's interesting. I think most people just discount the stories of the fireballs as sort of Christian piety after the fact. Very interesting.
Can you talk for a minute about how this subject in particular became the thing that has consumed you for several years now?
Yeah, I've always been very interested in the Roman Empire. And the story I usually got, picked up passively or actively, is that civilization was at this high pitch with the Roman Empire, and then came the Dark Ages, and things didn't recover until the Renaissance. And I was always wondering, what would have happened had the Roman Empire not fallen? You know, would we have landed on the moon in 969 instead of 1969? Where would we be as a civilization? And was the Dark Ages really inevitable? And then as I was reading it, about that moment when the Roman Empire fell, I discovered all these references to an Eastern half that hadn't fell, and all those questions were actually answered. The story continued, another 1,000 years, and it was a bit like winning the lottery. You know, this, wow, Roman history goes on until, you know, it falls only 39 years before Christopher Columbus discovers America. There's a whole huge lost history that, you know, I'd never heard about, no one had ever talked about. And it's just an engrossing story, and I just felt like I needed to share it with someone, which is why I started the podcast.
Is there a lot of English language scholarship into the subject, or did you have to go to translated texts to really get the amount of information to the depth that you wanted it?
I had to basically get translated texts, but there are more and more there's more and more interest in the Byzantines, and more, just usually specific, like the reign of Justinian, or Justinian II, or individual emperors in the empire. But there's more and more interest in it. But for the most part, I had to use translated text.
Let's go next on the phones to Sam in Dallas. Hello, Sam.
Hello.
Hi, Sam.
Hi there.
Go right ahead, please.
Yeah, good afternoon. I have Persian ancestry, and I recall during elementary, even high school, in the ancient Persian history, they used to tell us about one of the Byzantine, which we call Byzance. Actually, they even don't call it Byzance. They call it, as you said, Eastern Roman Empire. And apparently an emperor by the name Valerian, the way which we used to say, or maybe Valerian or whatever the correct pronunciation is, lost very badly to a Persian empire by the name, we call it Shapur I. And apparently he was the emperor, the Eastern Roman emperor was humiliated very badly, and they used to say in the history the Persian emperor used to use him as a step to get on his horse. I was wondering if you could shed some light on that area for me.
Thanks for your call.
Sure, yeah. As I said, the Persian War really dragged on. It didn't matter if there was technically a peace. There was always bad blood. There was always someone fighting on the border. And one Roman emperor, Valerian, decided that he was going to do something about it. He marches out, gets defeated, gets annihilated by Shapur's army. And he is indeed used as a footstool. Some sources say the Persian king treated him very well as a distinguished captive. Others say that he was used as a footstool. But most agree that after he died, he was flayed, and they stuffed his skin with straw and hung it up in their temple. And then they would force visiting Roman delegations to meet right underneath the wall where the skin of their former emperor was hanging. And that was one of the reasons why Roman emperors like Julian the Apostate kept trying to invade Persia. You know, partly was to avenge this, and partly was to recover the skin and give it a proper burial.
Yeah, we should say that for all of their achievements, these were not people with any shortage of barbaric ideas about making a point. Can you talk about, do you pronounce it Nicephorus?
Nicephorus.
Nicephorus, thank you.
Yeah, Nicephorus the First was the emperor actually right after Irene that we had talked about. And Nicephorus went to war against a really nasty Bulgarian king named Krum. And he lost the battle, and he was killed in the process. And afterwards, Krum had his body found. They identified it by the purple boots that only an emperor could wear. And they cut off his head and displayed it on a stick for a while. And after a couple days of public ridicule, Krum had it lined with silver and turned it into a drinking cup. And he would force visiting Byzantines to drink a toast out of the skull of one of their former emperors.
I'm sad to say that we're just about out of time, and that's going to have to be the last image that we leave with. But Lars Brownworth is a former high school history teacher and creator of the podcast Sensation, 12 Byzantine Rulers. His new book is called Lost to the West, The Forgotten Byzantine Empire That Rescued Western Civilization. Lars, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.